I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we continue our Reflections on Afghanistan series, this time with one of my favorite guests, Richard Falk, international law scholar and professor emeritus at Princeton University. He joins us on this edition of the program to discuss Afghanistan as it relates to Vietnam, and his observation that it seems, at least in a post-colonial context, that an occupying force, even when it has superior military might, will not inevitably defeat the nation it occupies. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, continuing our Reflections on Afghanistan series. Welcome back to Parallax Views, one of my favorite guests that has graced this program, Richard A. Falk. How are you doing today, Richard?
It's super hot here in Turkey, but other than that, I'm okay. Even though the world is suffering a number of afflictions at the moment, and they don't make me politically happy, but my personal life is fine.
So I wanted to have you back on because I'm doing a series of reflections on the war in Afghanistan, and I wanted to get your thoughts first on the military intervention into Afghanistan. I believe you've had evolving views on that. I know you wrote an article appraising the Afghanistan war, and then I think it was a decade later you also wrote Rethinking Afghanistan. So what were your initial views on the military entrance into Afghanistan, and how have those views changed over time?
Yes, I would regard my initial views as perhaps the biggest miscalculation of my political life, in the sense that I was persuaded that the 9/11 attacks were authentic and that there was a real danger of further kinds of mega terrorism that justified trying to remove the danger. And I accepted the related argument that Al-Qaeda's presence in Afghanistan was tied to a sympathetic and very extremist Taliban regime there that really didn't have the qualities of minimally humane governance that would accord it legitimacy. So I wrote an article in Nation magazine favoring intervention. But I very soon regretted that I did that for several reasons. One, it became clear that there wasn't such a close connection between what happened at 9/11 and the Taliban government. Secondly, that the U.S. seemed to want to militarily intervene and not rely on a kind of diplomatic approach to resolving the concerns post 9/11. And thirdly, it reminded me again that intervention is rarely successful in the post-colonial world, and that it generates nationalist resistance even when a population doesn't like its own government, that it dislikes even more in those circumstances foreign interveners. This is a situation that I think has surprised the Americans in Iraq, particularly, where it was expected that because of the unpopularity of Saddam Hussein, Americans would be welcomed as liberators, as they were to some extent in Germany after World War II. And that when that didn't happen, again, there was a failure to appreciate the reasons that lead a people to resist foreign intervention in this post-colonial period.
So I know one aspect of Afghanistan that really interested you are some of the parallels we can draw between, say, Vietnam and Afghanistan. You, of course, visited Hanoi during Vietnam. What are the parallels that exist, and what do you think is most significant about those parallels? Because I think, as you point out, they raise some very significant questions.
Yeah, well, I think the most startling parallel is that, having experienced the humiliation of the collapse of the Saigon government and the chaotic escape of Americans and Vietnamese collaborators in 1975, the U.S. government failed to handle and understand the situation in Afghanistan well enough to avoid a repetition of that experience. And to some extent, it showed the liabilities of believing in your own propaganda and supposing that the trillions of dollars that we spent equipping and training a 300,000 Afghani army would at least hold off a Taliban victory and occupation of the main cities for long enough for the U.S. and its Afghani friends to get out of the country. And so this was a failure of learning from historical experience, compounded with dangerously faulty intelligence, and a president that seemed not to care very much about what happened to the Afghan people, and was only concerned with withdrawing and ending this forever war that was obviously not winnable. They understood that the war was lost, and the Doha negotiations, which preceded this Taliban victory by a couple of several months, was basically a political acknowledgement by the United States that its mission had failed in Afghanistan. And despite that, there wasn't enough appreciation of the real balance of forces in the country to prevent this kind of chaos from accompanying the Taliban victory.
So I want to get into what's been called the Saigon moment with Afghanistan and Biden's exit strategy. But First, one thing that I was really interested in unpacking with you is I think you've made this point before, if I recall correctly, but it seems as if, despite the U.S. being this huge military power, right? Ultimately, despite that military superiority, it cannot overcome, it seems, in the case of Vietnam and Afghanistan, self-determination. Could you comment on that?
Yes, I think that is true, and it's also been true in Iraq and elsewhere in the world, less prominent ways. And as I tried to say earlier, the political class holds on to this view that military superiority is the principal agent of historical change, and that no longer applies in the post-colonial situation that exists in Asia, Africa, particularly. And why that is a complex question. I think it arises partly because the anti-colonial wars demonstrated that national resistance, even if it produces massive devastation and human suffering, eventually prevails against a superior military intervener. And that is because for the intervening side, it's a cost-benefit analysis of whether the intervention is worthwhile. Nothing of real core values or core security is really at stake. But for the other side, for the national resisting side, its whole identity and national self-esteem and autonomy and the most fundamental values of a self-governing polity are at stake. And therefore, it's willing to willing and able to outlast the militarily superior intervener that has eventually suffers from a fatigue syndrome and acknowledges that it can't at acceptable costs prevail. And then and that it's partly pushed by its public that is tired of paying for an unwinnable prolonged war, and partly by splits in the elite that recognize that this is throwing money after a lost cause, into a lost cause. So each situation is different, of course, and Afghanistan has many distinctive elements. And one of the elements that's very important and hasn't been commented upon much is that the Taliban seems to be learning from and relying on Russian and Chinese advice and Chinese really provides a kind of model for how to deal with the West and how to establish sovereignty under difficult conditions. And the evidence is increasing that this new look that the Taliban is emphasizing in this second coming is partly a sophistication that has been encouraged by Russian and Chinese diplomats. And whether it holds, it's very important whether the pledges of treating women differently, of not having as extreme a version of Sharia law applied, and allowing, ensuring that no Afghan base for transnational terrorism will exist. All of these elements are new elements in the Taliban's effort at public relations with the outside world, which it has made much greater effort in this new period. And as I say, whether those efforts will hold up in the face of provocations from the West, including cutting off all the governmental assistance to a country that is 90% below the $2 poverty line and really has will have trouble feeding its people without foreign economic assistance. So the future is quite complicated and uncertain, I think.
So in regards to what we were saying about intervention and self-determination, I guess in some ways you could say that for the nation that is being intervened upon, you know, the threat is one that's existential, whereas it's not existential necessarily for the intervener.
Yes. No, that's a that's a good point. There's, in my view, there's only a propaganda threat for the intervener, its own propaganda. Those threats, in retrospect, are non-existent. I mean, Vietnam has turned out to be, if anything, a source of stability within its region and even a model of development, eliminating the poverty of its population in one generation. And Afghanistan also could be, it certainly wasn't a threat to the U.S. After the initial intervention. By any stretch of the imagination. So there was the second, the counterterrorism justification, which, as I admit, I myself accepted at the outset, was not a justification for this nation-building undertaking that was a direct assault on Afghani self-determination. And that's where the, as you say, the absence of an existential threat from Afghanistan eventually led the United States to try to cut its losses and get out of the situation where it had spent billions and I think lost close to 5,000 Americans who were killed in the during this period of occupation, committed lots of atrocities, war crimes. That's the whole Snowden story. The whole Snowden story is Chelsea Manning's story is an Assange. Are stories of trying to prosecute the people that leaked the documents which exposed the war crimes committed by American military in Afghanistan. And that's another aspect of this whole situation that is now not being very much discussed.
So in regards to President Biden and the way we exited, I'm very torn right now because I think it was handled very poorly, to put it mildly. But at the same time, I'm also frustrated with some of the sort of media and political class saying, well, we should just stay there forever, you know, or in perpetuity. So how should we think about how President Biden has handled this and the withdrawal just more generally?
Well, I think, as I tried to say, I think there is no excuse for the way in which Biden handled this terminal phase. At the same time, as you have just pointed out, the impulse to end the forever war, which was shared with Trump, of course. Trump was proposing an end to the American involvement in Afghanistan. So in some sense, it's a rare example of foreign policy bipartisanship in this period. But now, of course, the Republicans and the militarist part of the American political scene will jump on Biden and accuse him of losing Afghanistan as the way China was lost and other Vietnam was lost. And it's that neoconservative backlash against failed foreign policy initiatives. And those that try to acknowledge the failure are sort of scapegoated in the process. So indeed, the two parts of your reaction are fully justified and quite consistent in the sense that Biden shouldn't be criticized for getting out. He can be criticized fairly for the way he got out. And it's important that the two dimensions of this last phase are kept analytically separate so that we understand what was, that the impulse to end the involvement was, I wouldn't say admirable, but it was sensible. And the negligence in the way we have gotten out is lamentable and inexcusable.
Do you think there was another way that the exit could have been handled? And I know that's a heavy question. We're not in Biden's shoes. We're not in anyone else's shoes. But how do you think this could have been handled differently?
Well, I think it could have been handled differently. First, in the Doha negotiations, they should have quietly been removing those Afghans that wanted to leave and had been implicated in the occupation or in the corruption of the government or in some of the war crimes, whatever the rationale. If they wanted to leave, that should have been done quietly and prior to the withdrawal of the American forces. And there was already the acknowledgement of a political defeat by the very fact of those Doha negotiations, but handling that defeat in a way that was sensitive to the Afghan reality was not part of the picture.
What is the Afghan reality that we had to acknowledge?
Well, the first thing is that obviously the Afghan people rejected foreign intervention. And the second thing is that the Taliban, without notable foreign military and economic assistance, clearly prevailed over a heavily subsidized Afghan army and security system that we had spent 20 years trying to develop, and that there is no way to revive a interventionary role by the West or by NATO. The best one can hope for is some kind of maybe Turkish role in the country, and as I said earlier, Chinese and Russian constructive relationship. I noticed that the Taliban has tried, in contradiction to its past, to make good relations with Iran, which, you know, the Taliban is this extreme Sunni style Islamic orientation, and Iran, of course, is Shiite, and it was an enemy of the Taliban in the first period of its governance, 1996 to 2001. So that's suggesting a different diplomacy on the Taliban's part, a more outward effort to deal with neighbors and to govern in a way that is more moderate. Whether that happens, we can only wait to see the results, and hopefully the West will not repeat the efforts to impose sanctions and engage in destabilization moves, so-called hybrid warfare that would make life much more difficult in a situation that economically is already in crisis.
So I just had a few more brief questions. The first one is, when it comes to our being in Afghanistan for, you know, these 20 odd years, why have we been there so long? Is there something that can be said about who benefited from the forever war?
Yeah, well, there are all sorts of mercenary beneficiaries in terms of a large number of contractors, translators, all sorts of construction contracts and training contracts. And there are a lot of, in other words, somewhere in that zone between private sector enterprise and corruption, a lot of activity occurs, and sustains a long intervention. Then those that advocated the intervention in the first place are reluctant to admit they made a mistake, so they constantly argue for new tactics, new augmented capabilities, increased economic commitments, and they deny the reality of a losing engagement, so that the war is sustained, as I've tried to argue, by our own, we're victims of our own propaganda, and somehow think that we're winning a war, that winning over time a struggle that we're actually losing. What Daniel Ellsberg tried to do with the Pentagon Papers was to show the American people the true story, what was being told inside the establishment and what the public was being told. And it's that discrepancy that, first of all, is a deficiency of democracy and a failure of trustworthy leadership. And that is present in this case, I believe, also. Obama is partly responsible. You know, he made this distinction between Iraq being an unnecessary war and Afghanistan being a necessary war, a good war. And he was trying to pursue a kind of middle path that wouldn't alienate the Pentagon and the military sectors of American foreign policy establishment, and at the same time reduce the combat role, at least in the Middle East.
I just wanted to add to that it's interesting. We now have the Afghanistan papers coming out, which, you know, it seems like a repeat of the Pentagon papers. I just read about in the Washington Post, the Afghanistan papers are showing that we were systemically lied to about progress being made in Afghanistan.
Oh, I hadn't known that. Of course, it doesn't surprise me because it's built into the structure of these regime-changing failed interventions, that they have to somehow maintain confidence. Otherwise, and they have to maintain confidence in the undertaking. Otherwise, they couldn't continue to get political support. There is a kind of illusion that over time they can correct the shortcomings of the intervention. In the meantime, lots of people are benefiting from the intervention in terms of these private entrepreneurial connections.
So there were only two more questions I had. The first is, in terms of being against interventions like the one in Afghanistan or in Iraq, people will say that we're isolationists, and I don't think either of us are isolationists. So how do you respond to people who say that withdrawing is a sign of isolationism or that it's Trumpian?
Well, I think it's a red herring in this kind of context, because the opposite of intervention is not isolationism. It's a security policy that serves the interests and values of the country. And when you are withdrawing from a intervention where there was no existential threat to America, you're not engaging in an isolationist move. You're ending a highly imprudent, immoral, and unlawful pattern of behavior that you would hope a country that claims to be democratic, that claims to respect international law, would want to restore that kind of reputation of being a responsible international actor, which the country had after World War II. It was seen as essentially responsible and far from isolationist. And it, what I think happened was the long period of geopolitical tension that accompanied the Cold War led to a whole militarized approach to security and the way in which the state operates globally that is in a way the opposite of the good side of isolationism, which is not meddling in the affairs of other countries, respecting their sovereignty, and not expending our resources on a whole string of foreign military presences. We spend almost as much as the whole world put together on the military capabilities. I mean, and that's a shocking statistic. And we spend something like more, we definitely spend more than the next 10 countries combined. So there's something, a mismatch between the security that is present and the investment in the overinvestment in military capabilities. And what follows from that, which is an exaggeration of international threat and a disposition to somehow show that we need this military capability. You remember Madeleine Albright made that famous statement about what's the use of all this military capability if we never use it.
So I also wanted to comment on that real quick. I feel like one of the problems with Afghanistan, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but you know, we put all this effort into dealing with the situation through a military sort of lens. But what about, you know, could we have done more with regards to helping economic development or infrastructure in Afghanistan that would have actually been more helpful to the Afghan people than primarily focus on the military aspect?
I think so, but I think that too would have been a losing proposition because we come in to a country without there being an infrastructure that could receive outside assistance and use it constructively and productively. I think we did try to build schools and hospitals and do certain things, but it didn't have the human infrastructure and it obviously didn't win the support of the people. 90% or so of the public were opposed to the American presence in Afghanistan, and that even though they were also opposed to the Taliban, or at least a high proportion of the population. So I don't think state building by a geopolitical actor works in the post-colonial period. If you really want to help, you have to do it at least through international institutions and maybe the UN or IMF, World Bank. It's just one step removed, but at least it's a step removed from doing it as a undertaking of a single country.
So wrapping up here, another thing I get from a lot of people that oppose the withdrawal is, you know, think about the Hazaras or think about women and girls and their rights and how they may be treated under the Taliban. How do you respond to those sort of criticisms? Because, you know, I care about the Hazaras. I care about the rights of women and girls, but I'm not sure that staying there is going to fix the problem.
Yeah, well, the staying there is really not an option because it would prove so costly and so unsuccessful after 20 years of attempting to do this. And I think a much better approach would be to try to encourage the Taliban to live up to its new pledges, which are to respect the rights of women, to enable education, to enable women to participate in professional life, and reward them for moving in that direction. I mean, in other words, hoping to generate constructive responses from within Afghanistan itself, not trying to do it from without.
What are the lessons that we need to learn from the Afghanistan intervention?
Well, I think the primary lesson is to engage in self-criticism, which centers on the tendency to overvalue military capabilities, to learn from the Chinese ascendancy that influence in the 21st century is more a matter of economic and psychological assistance or expansion, providing other countries with win-win situations, not interfering with their internal development, respecting their sovereignty. I think that's the primary lesson. And the reason I emphasize the Chinese is that they have basically pursued this kind of expansionist strategy. They have not relied on military power. They have not tried to intervene politically. They have tried to present other countries with win-win outcomes based on infrastructure development and other ways of participating in the development of other countries, which benefits China, but also benefits the recipient and doesn't threaten the sovereignty of the country. And then the other lesson, I suppose, is to be skeptical about what the intelligence community tells the politicians, and for the politicians to try to chart a humanitarian path that doesn't depend on assessing, doesn't depend on relying on the sorts of failed capabilities that we've tried to establish in foreign societies and then try to terminate. It's a complicated set of issues. And as I say, it goes back to a political class that advises leaders, not only in the United States, but throughout the world, that has lost essential touch with reality and doesn't comprehend the gravity of other non-military threats like climate change, COVID, and which call for solidarity rather than for a conflict with adversaries, which have been intensified in this post-Cold War period rather than being minimized.
Well, Richard Falk, I want to thank you once again for coming on Parallax Views. I'm sorry for some of the tech difficulties. If there's anything you want to add in closing, I know a lot of my listeners always ask for your wisdom on, you know, maintaining hope in what seems like dark times. We've dealt with COVID. I think a lot of people are very worried about Afghanistan right now. What would you say to people, especially my younger listeners, that are feeling pessimistic about the future?
Well, I'd say that we're not smart enough to know what the future holds, and therefore we should accept that we're living in a time of radical uncertainty, and it vindicates struggling for that which we believe to be right and just, and redeeming our own lives, not by trying to predict the future, but trying to construct a future that will serve humanity.
I think that's great.
Thinking ahead, I mean, thinking of our relations with the natural surroundings, the ecological balance, and coming to the understanding that we have more in common with people throughout the world than this state structure leads us to believe, which is sort of rooted in conflictual external relations. We need a global community, which doesn't presently exist. And I think good citizenship in the 21st century has to have a future-oriented perspective and a global humanist and ecological perspective. It's a time of biopolitics rather than geopolitics.
In other words, I would just add to that, ultimately, you know, if we're going to deal with ecological crises that are looming, we're going to need to work together as yes, you know, a global community.
Exactly.
Thank you again, Richard Falk, for coming on Parallax Views.
It's always good to be with you, JJ.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Richard Falk, one of my favorite guests. As always, if you appreciate the work I do, and I get a lot of comments saying that a lot of people do appreciate my work, and if you're one of those people, please, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There's everything from a $1 to a $15 tier. $5 tier gets you some bonus content that I should be posting more of tomorrow, and the $10 and $15 tiers get you a producer's credit shoutout, which means it's that time again, producer's credit shoutouts to Spartacus, Gunner, Ed, Jamie, James, Ork, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Martin, Gratz, Chase, Emilia, Mickey, Brian, and The War Nerd. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at, again, patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff It's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.